This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
Thank you.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Dozens of Palestinians are injured as Israeli soldiers and settlers attack protesters angry at restrictions imposed by Israel during the holy month of Ramadan. The Yemeni army says it has launched successful drone attacks on a Saudi military base in Khemais Mushayyat and an Aramco oil facility in Jazan. Also coming up, Pakistan's parliament is set to resume debate about the expulsion of the French envoy amid public anger over Islamophobic measures in France. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society says 100 people have been injured after Israeli forces attacked protesters in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli forces fired stun grenades and water cannons to disperse the Palestinian demonstrators. They were protesting restrictions on their gatherings in Jerusalem, Al-Quds Old City, during the fasting month of Ramadan. The Palestinian Prime Minister has condemned the violence as institutionalized terrorism of Israel against Palestinians and their sanctities. Mohammed Shataya said such acts of aggression are aimed at Judaizing Jerusalem, Al-Quds. He called for the international condemnation of the Israeli violence. The latest clashes came after videos posted online showed Palestinians being harassed Wednesday night by Israeli youths shouting, quote, death to the Arabs. The Yemeni army says it has conducted retaliatory drone strikes on targets inside Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said two Qassam 2K drones attacked the King Khalid Air Base in the southwestern Saudi city of Khemais Mushayyat. He added that in a separate attack, a Samad drone targeted a facility belonging to Saudi Arabia's oil company Aramco in the Jizan province. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have escalated retaliatory attacks in recent months. They are pushing for the lifting of a blockade and the cessation of aggression that has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. Edward Corrigan is an international lawyer and commentator. He believes that Yemen is acting well to defend itself against the Saudi war that has created the world's worst man-made catastrophe there.
All of these attacks are illegitimate, and of course the Saudi intervention into Yemen also is illegitimate. Now, the Saudis have been relentlessly bombing, you know, every day, but usually it's civilian targets, you know, and infrastructure, hospitals, schools, food protection facilities, even, you know, the Yemeni government based in Sana'a, you know, retaliating in a way that they can. And they're targeting military facilities and oil infrastructure, which I think is legitimate. And for the most part, I've not heard of them targeting strictly civilian areas. The other point of note is that the Saudis seem to be almost totally unable to stop these attacks, whether by predators or by drones or by missiles. And that is a point, even though the Americans and the British are helping the Saudis with missiles and stuff, so sometimes they do stop them. But for the most part, no. They seem to be able to, the Yemenis seem to be able to target any, place at will. And they're very successful and have been very pinpoint in their target, defending it. So Yemen has, even though it's a poor country and it doesn't have anywhere near the technology that the Saudis have, and the Saudis are buying them from the United States and Britain and France and other countries, but they have put up a tremendous fight and have adapted incredibly and have created their own indigenous, military infrastructure with drones and missiles that they can strike back at the Saudis almost at will.
Iraqi security officials say at least three rockets have landed in the perimeter of Baghdad International Airport. The officials said the rockets struck near the area of which the airport houses U.S. forces. No damage or casualties have been reported. There was no immediate claim of responsibility either. On Sunday, five rockets targeted an Iraqi airbase located north of Baghdad that hosted U.S. soldiers and warplanes. U.S.-led facilities, forces, and supply convoys in Iraq have repeatedly been targeted in recent months. Anti-American sentiments are running high in the Arab country after the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in January last year. The Iraqi parliament then voted for the withdrawal of American troops from the country. Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says under international law, the Iraqi people have every right to resort to force to remove the occupation.
Well, the Iraqi people have every right to do this because under international law, occupation is illegal, and the occupied peoples have the right to use force to remove the occupation. This is a basic tenet of international law. And so every minute that the United States remains occupying Iraq, which it occupied in a war of aggression, which is the supreme war crime under the Nuremberg precedents, meaning every American that took part in this war in Iraq deserves to be executed for the worst war crime there is. It's worse than genocide. According to Nuremberg, the worst crime that Germany committed during World War II was launching a war of aggression. And that precedent held up until the false flag events of September 2001. Since then, the United States has launched several totally unprovoked wars of aggression, including the war against Iraq, based on the false pretenses of so-called weapons of mass destruction that didn't even exist. The Iraqi people have heroically resisted this invasion and occupation, and indeed genocide. There's the book Genocide in Iraq that details how the U.S. invasion of Iraq has actually met the definition of genocide under international law. So the Iraqi people have been resisting from the very day that the Americans first landed, and they're continuing to resist now, and they're ramping up their resistance, and they are right under international law, and the Americans are wrong.
Elsewhere, Pakistan's parliament will resume a debate on whether to expel the French ambassador over the blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Lawmakers will hold the debate following a resolution that called off recent anti-France protests in Pakistan. The protests last week turned violent, leading to at least a dozen deaths. earlier this week, the government reached a resolution with the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, the TLP. That's the party that organized the rallies and called for the expulsion of the French envoy. The TLP waged its anti-France campaign months ago. It did so after the French government defended a satirical magazine to republish the Prophet Muhammad's cartoons. France's move drew strong condemnation from across the Muslim world. Javed Rana in Islamabad says lawmakers affiliated with Pakistan's ruling party are under pressure to vote in favor of the expulsion of the French ambassador, as doing otherwise might cost them the next elections.
The ruling party, which obviously doesn't want to want the expulsion of the French ambassador, but there are lawmakers and they understand the cost of opposing such move, because they know if they oppose the expulsion of the French ambassador, this could possibly cost them the next election. And even now, there have been protests against the interior minister, who was, in one way or the other, he was in charge of the part of the security operation against these protesters. So these lawmakers are already losing public support. They are quite under pressure to expel French ambassador, despite the fact that the government had a lot of manipulations not to do so.
The head of the U.S. Central Command, Kenneth McKenzie, says Iran possesses one of the most capable militaries in the Middle East. McKenzie was addressing the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. He said Iran's offensive capabilities include nearly short and long-range ballistic missiles, as well as an array of land attack cruise missiles. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region. On Tuesday, McKenzie testified before the U.S. House Armed Services Committee. He said Iran's widespread use of small and medium-sized drones means the U.S. is operating without complete air superiority for the first time since the Korean War. Iran has time and again stated that its military capabilities are merely defensive and are designed to deter foreign threats. Hundreds attend the funeral of African-American Donte Wright, who was fatally shot by a white policewoman in the U.S. state of Minnesota. Top state politicians and relatives of George Floyd, another black man killed by the Minnesota police, attended the service. The 20-year-old was laid to rest following a public viewing of his casket. Civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton made a speech at the funeral, slamming what he called the stench of racism in the United States.
Well, we come today as the air fresheners for Minnesota. We're trying to get the stench of police brutality out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racism out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racial profiling out of the atmosphere. We come to Minnesota as air fresheners, because your air is too odorous for us to breathe. We can't breathe in your stinking air no more.
Sharpton said the police must understand they aren't above the law. Wright was shot at a traffic stop in Brooklyn Center on April the 11th. The police say the officer mistook her handgun for a taser. The black man's death was one in a growing list of instances where African Americans are being killed at the hands of white police officers. The death of Floyd in Minneapolis in May last year sparked a wave of protests against police brutality and racial profiling in the United States. Well, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg says a reform of police is needed in the U.S., as the way African Americans are policed is different from that of white Americans.
The President said, we've heard, the Attorney General said, we've heard people all across America, from, you know, leaders to politicians to news people, everybody has recognized the fact that it has been here. And me, with 32 years of, you know, in law enforcement, having seen the issues across the board, having worked with departments all across this country, from Chicago, LA, New York, on dragnet operations and everything else, I've seen the culture. The culture is a double standard culture, and it is a different culture when it comes down to how do we police in black neighborhoods and African Americans, and how do we police white and affluent Americans. So it is a double standard, and it is time that we really, really begin to say something has to be done on reform on police.
A Pentagon commission has recommended that decisions to prosecute service members for sexual assaults be made by independent authorities, not commanders. That's according to a U.S. official. The official spoke on the condition of anonymity. He said Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has not made a decision yet. He said Austin would consult with leaders of the different military branches before making one. The last recommendation was made by the Pentagon Commission on Sexual Assault. Austin formed the commission in February. Sexual assault has been a problem in the U.S. military, with cases largely remaining underreported. Such cases have so far been decided within the military's chain of command. Russia's defense minister says he has ordered troops participating in military drills in the Crimea region to return to their bases from Friday.
I instructed the commanders of troops and military districts to plan in detail the return of the troops to their permanent deployment points.
Sergei Shoigu said the Russian troops demonstrated their ability to ensure the reliable protection of the country. The military exercises, which involve tens of thousands of troops and dozens of warships and aircraft, have raised tensions between Moscow and Kiev along with its Western supporters. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky welcomed the end of the war games, saying it could lead to reduced tensions exacerbated along the two countries' borders in recent weeks. NATO also said Russia's troop drawdown from areas near Ukraine's border is important and timely, but the alliance would remain vigilant. Turning to other news, EU lawmakers say it's not good enough that just 8% of EU citizens have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. This as lockdowns across the 27-country bloc are having a major economic impact. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
Some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not. Greece taking away quarantine and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states, and maybe in terms of age or gender, are some states not using AstraZeneca at all, and I fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
About 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed.
The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 7-0, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
a crisis this deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
the month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. On the 10th day of Ramadan, the loyal and unmatched wife of the Prophet of Islam, Lady Khadija, passed away. During the pre-Islam era, she used to be called Tahire, meaning spotlessly pure, as she was very chaste and pious. She was known as the master of the women of Quraysh tribe. She was also famous as a very wise and foresighted lady among the Arab people. Lady Khadija was very rich, hence she was also called as Malikatul Arab, or the Queen of Arabs. Some of the researchers maintain that she had got married before marriage with Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. But others, like Ja'far Murtaza Ameli, are of the opinion that the Prophet of Islam was the first and only husband of Lady Khadija, peace upon her. This great lady was a refuge for the needy and the destitute even before Islam. Lady Khadija generously put her entire wealth at the service of the Prophet and the cause of Islam. The Prophet described her, saying, "Khadija believed in me when others denied me, and accepted me when others rejected me, and rushed to help me with her wealth when others deprived me, and God granted me children through her that He didn't grant me through any of other wives." Lady Khadija was very kind toward the Prophet. When the Prophet entered the house, she would welcome him and sympathize with him. She would dust his face and tell him soothing words to alleviate the hardships that he had sustained from the polytheist. Ibn Ishaq, the first writer of the history of Islam, writes, "The Prophet would not hear any denial or saddening word from the disbelievers unless Lady Khadija would alleviate it. She would accept him and consider the insults of people as unimportant." All of us know that lying is one of the worst sins and is the source of many other sins. This sin deprives us from the divine mercy in this world and the hereafter. Lying also causes people not to trust us. According to the Islamic narrations, lying is the key to other sins. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Telling truth is invitation to doing righteous deeds, and doing righteous deeds is invitation to paradise." The 11th successor of the Prophet, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, also says, "All evils have been put in a room, and the key to that room is lie." One of the things that nullify fasting is to attribute lie to God, the Prophet, and the infallible Imams. It includes verbal attribution or written one. In view of this, a fasting person cannot narrate the statements from the Prophet and the Imams unless he or she is sure of the narration to be correct. This will nullify his or her fasting. The Prophet of Islam and the Imams of Isa Ahlul Bayt have highly recommended us to be optimistic at the time of praying. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, pray to God in a way that you are certain about its fulfillment. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, when you pray, at that moment, think that your need has been met and is ready. Now let us continue reciting another part of Dua Abu Hamza Somali. As we said in the previous episode, this supplication was taught to Abu Hamza by the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him. My Lord, had anyone known my sin except you, I would have not committed it, and had I feared hasty punishment, I would have refrained from it. Not because you are the meanest of seers, but because you are the best coverer and highest ruler and noblest of the noble. Where is your beautiful covering? Where is your great pardoning? Where is your near release? Where is your quick response to refugees? Where is your vast mercy? Where are your gracious bounties? Where are your sweet blessings? Where are your ample affair? Where is your great grace? Where is your corpulent bounty? Where is your old goodness? Where is your nobility, O noble? By your nobility, save me, O giver of bounties. I'm not the one to rely on my deeds to be saved from your punishment. I rely on your grace upon us because you are the giver of bounties and pardon sins nobly. So we do not know what to thank, whether the beauty that you have spread or the ugliness that you have covered. O friend of anyone who befriends you, an apple of eyes of anyone who takes refuge with you and cuts other bonds for your sake. My Lord, is it possible to see you doing against our optimistic wishes in you or frustrate our hopes in you? Never, O noble, my Lord. We disobeyed you while we hope that you will cover our sin. We called you while we hope that you will answer us and fulfill our hope. O guardian, indeed we know that we do not deserve it with our deeds, but we know that you will not expel us from your door, although we are not entitled to your mercy. But you are such that you forgive us, O forgiver. By your light we were guided, and by your grace we were became needless. And with your bounty we spend our day and night. Our sins are before you. O God, we seek forgiveness for them and return to you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
Iraqi Kurds, long accused of covert cozy ties with Zionist Israel, are watching on with amazement as Israel befriends allegedly hostile Arab countries. Normalization between Arab countries and Israel are changing geostrategic realities for them. After the occupation arrived in 1948 and as Arab hostility toward constant Israeli aggression intensified, the occupying entity tried to reach out to non-Arab communities in West Asia. It found an opening with Iraq's Kurds, who had a dream to separate from the central government in Baghdad. Israel then sought to provide military support to Kurds who were fighting Saddam Hussein's military campaigns in the north throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. In 2017, Israel backed a controversial independence referendum in northern Iraq, even as Erbil's allies, including the United States, opposed the vote. And now, as the Kurds watch several states normalizing with the region's historic foe Israel, they feel eager to take their relationship with Israeli intelligence and occupation forces out to the open, but they cannot do it on their own. They need Iraq to do it first, since Baghdad manages foreign policy. If an Israeli embassy opens in Baghdad tomorrow, the day after, an Israeli consulate will be open in Erbil. This is what KRG officials openly say. However, the Iraqi resistance has a different opinion. Regional media reported last week that an Israeli Mossad outpost came under attack in northern Iraq Tuesday, April 13 at night, and that a senior Israeli intelligence agent was killed while several other Mossad agents were wounded. Such incidents, along with the constant attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Erbil Airport, puts leaders of the KRG at a hot spot for not being able to keep their regions away from harm's way by engaging in unholy alliances with Iraq's main foes, Israel and the U.S. By supporting Kurdish separatism, Israel hopes to steer the region in a new direction and by extension encourage other ethnic and religious groups in the region to seek to emulate the Kurdish example. By deliberately seeking to dismantle the existing multi-ethnic, multicultural, and multi-religious nation states, Israel's quest to be recognized as a purely Jewish state would no longer be an aberration, or so it hopes. But we already know that it is not going to happen as long as the region's resistance is alive and capable. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Kurds are fond of saying that they have no friends but the mountains. Yet one entity has pushed for their separation from both Iraq and Syria over many decades, Israel. The relationship between the two has evolved to the point where Israel is the only voice in West Asia encouraging rather than decrying the Kurdistan separation from Iraq. Netanyahu first publicly voiced support for an independent Kurdish state in June 2014 as the threat of Daesh was rising. However, that fantasy was blocked by the Iraqi resistance's elimination of Daesh, ridding the Kurdish Contras from Daesh threat. Yet Kurdish separatists still choose Israel over the resistance any day. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. Now, this is a very interesting topic here, specifically that the leaders of northern Iraq's Kurdistan regional government are always happy to receive Israeli support, given the international opposition to the Kurdish plans to disintegrate from Iraq. We have Kurdish leaders who could not openly celebrate their Israeli encouragement for fear of repercussions from the rest of Iraq, who link aspirations for Kurdish independence with the ideology of Zionism itself, which we have been seeing for the past 72 years. In what ways do you think the Kurdish separatists believe Israel can actually benefit their demands?
It's the same delusion that many before the Kurds have fallen into, and well, here we're talking about a small minority that is requesting the support of an imperialist against its own region. And we remember what happened to the indigenous tribes in Mexico when they sided, some of them, with the Spanish invaders against the Aztecs. And obviously the Spanish, as soon as we're done with the Aztecs, eliminated and ethnically cleansed those indigenous small tribes. And so it's a delusion for any person to side with imperialists against the people of his region, his or her region. And there's never been in history that this ended well. And it seems like the elite in the Kurdish people have not learned from history.
Well, the Kurdish regional government released an official statement last week on Wednesday denying certain reports that were present in the media, especially in the regional media, claiming that there were unknown forces that attacked a certain area, and which is a Mossad facility in the KRG, and it killed Israelis in northern Iraq. Now, at the same time, we have attacks on U.S. Bases all across Iraq, especially those who are stationed in Kurdistan, and now possible attacks against Mossad agents as well. What will be the result of such constant upheaval in northern Iraq that was once safer than actually Baghdad?
You see, the result will be continued fighting in the region as long as the Kurds do not reconciliate with their surrounding, with their brothering and cousins in Iran, in Turkey, in the Arabic world. They will continue to be played by imperialist and apartheid Israel for the goals of not achieving them peace or stability or independence, but to undermine their brothers and neighbors. That's the ultimate goal that apartheid Israel is working on. That's the ultimate goal of the United States involvement in Iraq and Syria on the side of the Kurds. It is not for their betterment, it's for the detriment of everybody else around them, which means they will also, their house will be burning down with their surrounding. You know, you look at what's happening in North Iraq right now with the ethnic cleansing of Nineveh, of the Babylonian and Assyrian and Syriac and Arab peoples of that region, and the after the invasion of ISIS and the Wahhabi contrast, and how these Kurdish contrasts themselves actually, instead of after the defeat of ISIS in that region, allowing the people of the indigenous populations of that region to come back, have taken it over and included it in their fake new independent province or area of Iraq. So we have now Kurds that are encroaching on the traditional lands of Semitic people, Assyrians, Babylonian, and Arab, and this will not end well.
Well, this sort of covert relationship between both the Kurdish side and the Israeli side began when the Ba'ath Party was still in power between 1968 and 1975. It was the most where they shared intel, and even Israel gave weapons to Kurdistan to fight off at that time Saddam Hussein. But we had Mustafa Barzani, the father of the current president of the KRG, Masoud Barzani. He was leading a rebellion against the Iraqi regime at that time. Now, Israeli security and intelligence agents help the Kurds with military assistance and with also arms. What benefits Israel from this relationship, obviously, other than having a foot inside of Iraq? What can they benefit from a disintegrated region?
You see, the goal of apartheid Israel in the Western Asia and North Africa, one of their main goals since the creation of Zionism, is to cut off the rivers that feed the Arab people. We're here talking about the Euphrates and the Tigris and the Nile. And so you look at how the relationship between apartheid Israel, Turkey, and Ethiopia are very important into holding our people down. And, you know, and as we see right now in Egypt, the situation is deteriorating. You know, building this dam in Ethiopia will basically starve the people of Egypt. And here is the same thing happening in the Levant. The Turks built, 40-somewhat dams on the Euphrates and Tigris, and now the Kurds are coming to steal the lands that are the part of the Fertile Crescent that fed the Arab and the Semitic people for 40,000 years, you know, the land between the two rivers. So the aim here is to cut off the Arabic people from their ability to feed themselves, because that's one of the things that have kept the Arab people independent and able to resist imperialism and occupation for 20,000 years.
Well, given the past 10 years of war against terrorism, the region waged by the resistance against imperial powers who implanted hostile terrorists, Wahhabi-funded insurgents and Westerns one in the region in total, especially in Iraq and in the areas controlled by the Kurds as well in northern Iraq, they suffered a lot until the Iraqi resistance led by both martyrs, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Qasem Soleimani, went to help out, especially in Kirkuk, and rid the area of Daesh. Why is it so hard for the leaders of the KRG to accept that and to take a firm stance alongside the resistance, the Iraqi resistance, whom they share with the land, the sky, the nation, the pride?
Well, you know, unfortunate for the Kurdish people that they are cursed with such leadership that cannot even acknowledge a favor that was done to them and the saving of the Kurdish people in Iraq from these Wahhabi contracts that would have, you know, kidnapped and raped and all their children and women and killed their men if they were able to. So, you know, we know that the Kurdish people is different than their elite, and their elite, unfortunately, are corrupted to the bone, where they're not, their care is not about protecting their people. It's about stealing as much money as possible through the looting of the Iraqi oil, now the Syrian oil also, and taking all the money that comes in from the West and the weapons. And, you know, so you look at what's happening in Kurdistan, Iraq, and the disparity between this political elite and the people on the ground is huge. And ultimately, the hope is that there will be new movements within the Kurdish people that will, you know, push these elites out that are collaborating with imperialists.
Well, that remains to be seen as how the region is actually beginning to look like one which is waiting for fire to happen, or rather diplomacy to work throughout its sway. I want to thank you very much, Laith Maarouf, for being with us, political commentator in Beirut, to talk about the relationship between Israel and the Kurds of Iraq. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the U.S. bases in Iraq are being shot one after the other.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Another military base hosting U.S. troops in Iraq was targeted with drones carrying explosives on Wednesday morning, ending any illusions that President Joe Biden's strike on Iraqi resistance soldiers inside Syria would deter such retaliatory attacks. Now, no casualties were reported in the attack on the airport in Erbil, which doubles as a base for U.S. troops. Now, before U.S. occupation troops shook off the Erbil attack, another one hit them on Friday in the Ain al-Assad base located in the Anbar governorate of western Iraq. U.S. occupation bases under heavy fire across Iraq in this following report.
Renewed drone attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq show that the Iraqi resistance is keen on ridding its nation from U.S. occupation, as U.S. pressure on the government in Baghdad is heaping, while Biden seeks leverage over the Iraqi official decision to see the U.S. leave their country once and for all. Iraq, scarred by decades of U.S. invasion, war, and Western-backed terrorism, has been a strategic location for the U.S. occupation to face off with its main foe, Iran, while making sure that the Iraqi popular choice of resistance be suppressed. The resumption of retaliatory attacks against U.S. occupation bases in Iraq shows that the Iraqi resistance are now abandoning de-escalation and seeking leverage over their rivals. It seems we're back to last year when, for several months in 2020, rockets rained down on American sites once a week or more. However, this time, not only in Anbar or Baghdad, but also in northern Iraq's Kurdistan region. A drone dropped explosives targeting U.S. occupation forces stationed at Erbil Airport in northern Iraq late on Wednesday, April 14, with no reports of casualties. However, a separate rocket attack killed a Turkish soldier at a military base nearby. It was the first known attack carried out by an unmanned aerial drone against U.S. forces in Erbil, amid a steady stream of rocket attacks on bases hosting U.S. occupation forces and their embassy in Baghdad that Washington blames on what it calls Iran-backed militias. The U.S. still cannot fathom the thought that Iraqis have every right to defend their land, especially after their tragic history of the American invasion, occupation, theft, and embedding Tekfiri terrorism. Shortly before Wednesday's attack in Erbil, at least two rockets landed on a base to the west of the city that hosts Turkish forces, killing a Turkish soldier. Turkey also has troops in Iraq, both as part of a NATO contingent and a force that has attacked Kurdish separatist militants in the north. The Iraqi resistance had already expressed its opposition to the presence of the United States and Turkey and demand a full withdrawal of all foreign troops. But since all their words went unheard, they sought a louder form of expression, which definitely got the attention of all foreign occupation forces in Iraq.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Malmo is Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Firas. Now, Iraqi resistance factions have upped the stakes with drone attacks against U.S. occupation forces inside of Iraq, a technique which is actually favored elsewhere in West Asia, and it seems to be affordable, yet very accurate and very effective. Are we at a crossroad for the U.S. illegal presence in Iraq, or maybe is this the storm before the actual big explosion that might happen?
The Iraqi resistance has chosen a very strategic offensive against the U.S. occupation. This choice is very accurate and it doesn't risk Iraqi civilians' lives. Neither through their own action or through rough and disproportionate reactions from the U.S. occupation. It's enough headache and damage for the civilian Iraqis that their lives are endangered by the U.S. air missile defense system that they use around the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, because usually, and it's very often actually, that shrapnel from that missile defense system drops down on civilian houses and damages it. The Iraqi resistance are therefore slowly choking the occupation, and this will make them bleed to death. A big explosion could occur if the Americans make a stupid mistake, like, for example, a bigger operation against the resistance. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be in the planning, at least not openly. I think the Americans would instead certainly prefer pushing Iraqi security forces against the resistance, and thus both having an internal fight and getting a pause from the attacks. Hopefully that won't happen.
Well, Firas, the U.S. has been planning to leave Baghdad, especially the Green Zone in Baghdad, and move north towards Erbil, away from the constant attacks by certain Iraqi groups that don't really name themselves or give a bit of a vague name for themselves. Yet they now find themselves being attacked, and people are following them up there and attacking them because they are not welcome in Iraq. What are the U.S. options when it comes to dealing with such specific drone attacks?
The Americans have only one option now. Let's make use of their favorite phrase, as we got to use it. Although it was a long time that they used it themselves, they used to say that all options are on the table. I think the Iraqi resistance are telling the Americans now, you have only one option on the table, and that's leaving Iraq. It doesn't matter where in Iraq you move, we will follow you there. If they don't leave Iraq, they will have to face the consequences. As you mentioned, we've seen in the region, and especially in the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, the U.S. defense system can't protect the kingdom from this kind of kamikaze drones, regardless of how expensive or the state of the art they are. This is actually making the Americans very irritated. Expensive defense system can't protect them against cheap but effective drones. Mm-hmm. And the use of drones are probably even safer for the Iraqi resistance than missiles, because they can send them from a distance without a bigger security setup, and they don't leave any traces.
Well, politically, the U.S. keeps poking at the Iraqi government, at Qadhimi's government, after every attack it faces inside of Iraqi territories, despite the fact that the Iraqi parliament considers the Iraqi resistance part of the Iraqi army since 2017. And so basically, when the U.S. targets the Iraqi resistance, it is basically targeting the Iraqi army itself. Where does Qadhimi's government stand on this very crucial matter?
Well, it seems that the interim government of Qadhimi are trying to balance between the occupation and the request of the parliament, which in fact is the wish of the Iraqi people. The government is actually engaged in a dialogue with the representatives of the United States of America in Iraq. They're talking about a withdrawal, but regardless, the Iraqi people are receiving mixed signals. The interim government says that the troops will leave, but spokesman for the occupation army says another thing. Sometimes they're talking about moving north to northern Iraq, and sometimes you can hear the Secretary General of NATO saying that they will replace the U.S. occupation. So it's hard to know who is the honest guy here in the room. But U.S. forces have decreased in Iraq, and that's a fact. But I don't think it's because of the dialogue. I think it's because of the security concerns they have amid the ongoing attacks.
Well,
but that's not enough.
We have seen once again that the Iraqi file is pressing the Biden administration to make some sort of a firm stance towards its presence, its troops' presence inside of Iraq. It's illegal. Presence inside of Iraq, but Biden seems preoccupied these days, maybe with internal affairs or rather with Iranian JCPOA agreements that are going on or negotiations that are underway in Vienna as well. Can it be that the Iraqi events are also tied from an American point of view? They are tied to the Iranian deal as it is being propagated by the Western mainstream media that propagates everything that goes on in the White House.
I personally don't think that. It's true that Iran has evolved to a regional power, but it's far-fetched to attach everything in the region to the Iranian nuclear file. They say this every time there's an issue in the region, regardless of it, if it's about Lebanon, Yemen, or Iraq. But it's far from true. Unlike USA, Iran have allies which are connected to it ideologically, but they are very independent. Thus, they are acting with this independence, and that's why the Iraqi file is not connected at all to the nuclear file, the Iranian nuclear file.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States will sooner or later realize that they need to listen to the Iraqi people, and there's only one solution to the Iraqi file. Leave Iraq and period.
Well, there's one more file that the U.S. has not used, or maybe option that the U.S. has not used against the Iraqi people, which it had used against Yemen, against Syria, and against Lebanon, and that's sanctions. Do you think that might be one of the options on the table, and how do you think that would affect the internal economy and social fabric of Iraq?
Of course, that could be something that the United States will use as a B card, as a plan B. And if they use it, it will be a disaster to the Iraqi economy and to the Iraqi nation, because Iraq has already problems with the economy, and the oil is not at that price that they used to have it before. So it could be the situation could become like it's in Syria if they imply the sanctions.
So do you think that is actually one of the options that would maybe bend the arms of the Iraqi government?
Definitely, because when the United States of America are not able to reach its goals with military way, they go to the sanctions.
They go to the sanctions, and that basically is what the Iraqi government maybe is afraid of, but at the same time it shows that it is working against the maybe benefit and the demands of the Iraqi resistance. And that was the fear mainly when I ask a lot of my Iraqi friends about it internally. They say that they fear for the future of the Iraqi resistance. Do they have anything to really be afraid of?
I don't think that they need to be afraid of that, because before Ghazmi came to power, the Iraqi prime minister and government of Mr. Abdel Mahdi, they traveled to China and they made an agreement with China to sell approximately 100,000 barrels of oil a day for Chinese investment in Iraq. And now Ghazmi is giving about 200,000 barrels of oil in a day in the new deal he made with Jordan and Egypt. So Iraq, as with the case of Iran, they have a window to the east, to China, so they don't need to be afraid of the U.S. sanctions.
Mm-hmm. But yet the Iraqi government seems to be more than willing to abide by the demands of the Biden administration in fear that it might fall under certain sanctions or even more pressure. We still don't know what kind of pressure that the U.S. will be using against whether the Khatami administration or government in Iraq or the targets that it might hit the Iraqi resistance. But the Iraqi resistance has shown so far that it is not silent. It has a loud voice. It will target any occupying force all across Iraq, until their land is liberated. I want to thank you very much, Firas Ali, for being with us from Malmo to talk about how the U.S. is being targeted inside of Iraq and what options do both sides have. Thank you for being with us. And please stay tuned, because next week we have more news right here on the Mideast Stream.
Passing away of the First Lady of Islam. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartfelt condolences to you on a very doleful day. Today, we join in grief of the noblest lady of all times, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, who became orphan on the 10th of Ramadan at a very tender age, with the passing away of her beloved mother, Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her. So exalted was the position of this lady in the sight of God that as long as she was alive, no other spouse was taken by Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Thus, today is the sad day in the annals of history when the Almighty's last and greatest messenger,